This is East End Inc. Today, science writer Deva Sobel talks about her latest book, The Glass Universe, how the ladies of the Harvard Observatory took the measure of the universe. She spoke at Canio's Books Sag Harbor in April 2017. Ms. Sobel was introduced by Canio's Catherine Soka.
Who isn't transfixed by the night sky? If you live in a place where there's not a lot of ambient light, and you walk out in a clear night, and you look up, it's hard not to feel a connection to the universe that transcends science and our everyday modern life. Our speaker tonight charted a course into the glass universe. Many of you may know that Deva is an internationally renowned writer. She's the author of Longitude, which won the 1997 British Book of the Year Award, also Galileo's Daughter and the Planets. She's co-authored books with other writers, including the illustrated Longitude with William Andrews. And also, she's an award-winning former science writer for the New York Times, and has written frequently about science for the New Yorker, Audubon, Discover, Life, and other magazines. But as a photographer, I'm intrigued by the glass universe. You know, before digital cameras, before film existed, images were developed on glass plates. I'm not sure how many people are even aware of that, but that's really part of what the glass universe is all about. It's also a tale of women unheralded in time until Deva has brought them forward, who worked really as human computers to actually help astronomers determine distances, locations, and to chart the heavens. This was in the mid-19th century. It was at the Harvard College Observatory. I'd like to just tell the audience what Elizabeth Colbert has said about the glass universe and Deva. Like the women of the Harvard Observatory, Deva Sobel reveals worlds to us. The glass universe is sensitive, exacting, and lit with the wonders of discovery. We're all in for a great discovery. Please give a very warm welcome to Deva Sobel.
So welcome, everybody. My, this is a treat. I want to recognize William Taylor, who is a solar system ambassador, gives talks about the night sky. Also want to acknowledge my daughter, who's sitting over there. Zoe had an important part to play in this project, which I'll tell you about, because every story that I write has is ostensibly for the general public. But that's a difficult concept to think about when you're working on something. It's much easier to have a friendly person in mind as the audience for the book. And I've had a different person in mind for each book, and Zoe seemed like the ideal audience for this book, even though she's not what I would call a hardcore astronomy nut. She's a very serious reader, and she was interested in the women in this story and was asking me lots of questions about them, and is interested in the whole period of time up to women being given the right to vote. So it seemed like a story that if I could tell it to her, then that would be great. Because I have to admit, it's a story with a lot of science. And that's why it's not Hidden Figures. How many people have seen Hidden Figures? Okay, so I like to say that my ladies are the grandmothers of the Hidden Figures. Not only did they live long before them, but really their presence at the Harvard Observatory and their success at their mission there is, I believe, what convinced NASA Langley and the Jet Propulsion Lab to hire women in those kinds of positions. So I think there really is a strong connection. I first heard about this story more than 20 years ago, I was interviewing astronomer Wendy Friedman, who was the head of a Hubble telescope key project about the expansion rate of the universe. And she mentioned the name Henrietta Leavitt to me, and I'd never heard of her. So I went to find out more about Miss Leavitt, discovered she was working in a whole room full of women at Harvard in the 1890s. And that did not compute, Harvard and women. And I thought, wow, that's really a story. But it has taken me a long time to come around to it. And I'm happy to have finally done that. And as Catherine was saying, the story is a lot about photography, about the ability to capture images of the sky on photographic plates. So that's what I mean by the glass universe. There are still, at Harvard, 500,000 glass plate photographs that began to be accumulated in the 1880s. And I thought people might not have a concept of what that looks like. So I have a little show and tell. I actually have my own glass plate, a copy of a plate that Henrietta Leavitt worked on. This is how they're stored. Each one is in a paper envelope, all 500 plus thousand of them. And of course they're glass, so they're fragile. Some of them are more than 100 years old. This is actually a copy of one of them that she worked on. I should walk around a little bit so you get a look at this.
Do you want me to hold it for
you? Yeah, do you want to do that?
Sure.
So you can see it's a negative. The stars appear black on a white background. And there are numbers written on it. That's what she was doing. She was identifying certain stars because she noticed that they were variable stars. They changed their brightness over time. And she was tracking that from one photograph to another. There's also a big area that's got a red mark around it. Somebody noticed that while this photograph was being taken, this is an exposure of about 2 hours, a meteor just shot through the field of view, and there's a very faint track there. So these plates are not just museum relics, they're still in use. People visit the observatory to look at them. If you're an astronomer interested in a particular part of the sky now, you might want to know what it was doing 100 years ago. And you can find all of that in this collection. So the National Science Foundation considers these plates so important that it's paying for a major digitization project now. All this equipment had to be built, invented right there in the observatory. And once they're online, then people won't have to handle them, won't have to travel there to look at them. But the sad part is, to digitize them, the markings have to come off. And the markings are really the handiwork of the women who did all this work. So many of them were this size. Some were much bigger, 14 by 17, depending on which telescope was used. So there were telescopes at Harvard, but then the director had another observatory set up in Peru, so the stars of the southern hemisphere could also be photographed all through the night, every clear night, for 100 years. And that brought the universe indoors. So at the beginning of the story, the women who worked at the observatory were not allowed to use the telescope because that would have involved being up at night with the men. And there were concerns that the cold and the damp would be too difficult for ladies to endure. That changed pretty quickly. By 1896, when Annie Jump Cannon arrived, she had the right background and enough experience, and they put her right on the telescope. But the other women could work in the daytime and look at these plates through a magnifying glass or a microscope and see things that had never been seen before. Because in a two-hour exposure, stars will show up on a photographic plate that the most skilled observer using the most powerful telescope still can't see, because the retina does not accumulate light over time the way the photographic emulsion does. So the plates represented a giant leap in technology and a giant opportunity for these women. As many as 20 women at a time studying these plates and really making important discoveries, which is remarkable to me how little known this story was, how it waited for me. I spent a lot of time at Harvard working on it, and I asked several people there to read the manuscript as technical experts. And one of the people was a woman who was a full professor of astronomy at Harvard, because I would rather discover my mistakes before publication and have them pointed out to me later by snarky reviewers. But she got so excited and sidetracked. She completely quit looking through the astronomy and just focused on the women's stories. Here I am, I'm working here, and I never knew what they were doing. I always thought it was some kind of cute, quaint story, and realized they were really doing science. So she got so excited about it that she agitated to have the book launch at the observatory. Wow. She said, you need to come up here and teach us our history. So, and that's how I got the plate, because they made this for me as a thank you. So, I'm very happy about this.
This is East End Inc. on WPKN Radio. We're listening to science writer Deva Sobel talking about her book, The Glass Universe.
So, who were these women? At the beginning, they were the wives, sisters, daughters of the astronomers, roped in to necessary work that needed to be done. They were taught what to do. They had rarely more than a high school education, but they were smart and they learned how to do it. So that led to the next logical step was hiring women from outside the university family. Why not? And one of the first to come in started as a domestic servant. She was a Scottish immigrant, and she had come here as a bride. But then her husband disappeared, and she found herself alone and pregnant. So she was in desperate circumstances and took a job at the observatory in the residence as a maid. And the director immediately realized how bright she was. She had taught high school in Scotland. And he taught her how to do computing and analyzing the photographs. And then he helped her go home to Scotland to have her baby and promised her a real job if she would come back. So she came back. Eventually, she brought her son over as well. When he was 7, she brought him over, and she managed to put him through school all the way through MIT, and he became a mining engineer. So she was a working mother before that concept even existed. And most of the women who worked at the observatory didn't marry. If they did, they had to leave. Later, that changed, but as I said, there were no working mothers other than Mrs. Fleming. This woman who started as domestic servant was named Wilhelmina Fleming, and she spent the rest of her life working at the observatory, and she became the first woman to hold a Harvard University title. They made her the curator of astronomical photographs. And that job has been held by a woman ever since, still today. So there were several whose work really stood out. Mrs. Fleming became a foreign member of the Royal Astronomical Society. She was a member in good standing of the American Astronomical Society, and she was famous in her own lifetime. So the opportunity that was open to these women was remarkable, and that was thanks to the broad-mindedness of the director. Since it is the March for Science Day, just want to say a little something about scientists and what a bad rap they get, and how strange they, in what strange ways they are presented in the movies and on television. Just with emphasis on their weirdness, their lack of social ease, which is really ridiculous, I would like to say. But there is a mindset, and one thing I love about Edward Pickering, who was this fellow who was so generous to his women employees. Of course, he didn't pay them as much as the men, but we're still dealing with that now, so we can't heap too much blame on him. But he had several spare time pastimes, and one of them was putting together jigsaw puzzles. But he liked to do them without looking at the picture. That's the mentality, shape alone. And the presence of all these women at the observatory is interesting in itself, but what's even more interesting is that the work at the observatory was supported and funded primarily by women. And as a result of that situation, there were fellowships for women created so that a young woman could come and work at Harvard for a year with one of these Pickering fellowships for women, and then go off and get a job at another observatory. So one result of that situation was that they infiltrated the astronomy community across the country. But another result was that the existence of this fellowship fund created the potential for graduate studies. So when Pickering died and his successor, Harlow Shapley, came to Harvard, Shapley wanted to have a graduate education program in astronomy created at the observatory. There was none at Harvard. There was an undergraduate course, but and the observatory had not been in the business of teaching. They had been in the business of producing knowledge, not training future astronomers. So he instituted a graduate level program, and the only money he had to support graduate students were these fellowships for women. So he recruited the whole first crop of graduate students from the women's colleges, Vassar, Wellesley, Radcliffe, and the first Harvard PhD in astronomy was a woman. Not the first woman to get a PhD, the first person to get a PhD in astronomy from Harvard University was Cecilia Payne. So, and she had come here from England because she'd been told there was no future for her as an astronomer in England because she was a woman. But she knew about the situation at Harvard. She'd heard about those women. And she'd also heard about the glass plates. And she knew that that was the specific, unique resource she needed to do the research that she wanted to do. And by studying the plates, she was able to figure out the relative abundance of chemicals in the stars. And she kept coming up with a result that seemed ridiculous to her. You know, people had been identifying the chemicals in the stars for about 50 years by the time she came to Harvard. And a lot of the chemicals were exactly the same substances on Earth. So there was a general feeling that they would be in the same relative proportions. But from what she was seeing, it seemed that that hydrogen dwarfed everything else, that hydrogen was about a million times more prevalent than anything else. And she spoke to Shapley about it, and he thought that sounded impossible. So he referred her to the reigning authority, who also said that was just impossible. So in her thesis, she reported the finding, and she said that it was probably incorrect, but nevertheless, this is what she had come up with. And because she had called attention to it, it took only 4 years for the entire community of astronomers to come around and say, yes, it really is almost entirely hydrogen. So that was pretty good for a PhD thesis. So I've been talking for a long time. And I could go on, but I would much rather have a conversation or answer questions. Yes?
Can you give me a sense of the years? Because, and also you said the plates are at the observatory, so it wasn't, it's not at the Department of the History of Science at Harvard.
Okay, so the years, Pickering arrived in 1877, and he's got serious about photography in the early 1880s. So that's when it started. And the plates were taken through the 1980s. Not as often, though, because the technology kept changing. And the glass plates, so in the original the original observatory is up on a hill about a mile from Harvard Yard, and it was a beautiful old wooden building. And as soon as he started amassing these glass plates, he became paranoid about fire. And in 1893, oversaw the construction of a brick building specifically to hold the plates. And they're still in there. It's been expanded a few times, and that's where they all are. So they are on the observatory grounds.
And you handle the original, I take it.
Yes, and you can too. No, if you go up there and you knock on the door of the plate stacks and say you're interested, the curator will take some out and show them to you.
You mentioned that women were not married women, and I recently found out, for instance, years later, though, Margaret Sanger had to hide her marriage because she wouldn't be allowed to continue her education in nursing. So when did that change?
Depends what field you're in. But by the 1930s, women working at the observatory who got married didn't have to leave. And usually they married the other astronomers, so it was all in the family. Did the women study a particular area? So Henrietta Leavitt made her great discovery by looking at that object that's on the plate you looked at, which is called the Small Magellanic Cloud, and it's visible only from the southern hemisphere. So it was really important that the entire sky was photographed. Some of the plates don't look like black dots on a white background. They spread out the light of the stars into little strips, shaded strips, which are the spectra of the starlight, and some of the women were expert at looking at those and setting up a classification system to be able to distinguish the various types of stars. And they were given that as a challenge. We need a classification system. Look at the plates, see what kind of patterns you can discern in the spectra, and roll with it. And that classification system is still in use today. Every astronomer I ask has heard about these women because their work was really important. So Why are the stars classified as they are? Why do they have letters? The categories have letters. And the letters go O, B, A, F, G, K, M. So the letters started out in alphabetical order, but then they had to be scrambled when the pattern dictated that. And so even today, if you take an astronomy class, you learn that order with the mnemonic, oh, be a fine girl, kiss me. So everybody knows Annie Jump Cannon was responsible for that order of the. And then Henrietta Leavitt made a discovery that made it possible to measure distances in space. So everybody knows about her. I mean, everybody in astronomy. So Edwin Hubble used her discovery to prove that there were galaxies beyond the Milky Way and also that the universe was expanding. So it was important stuff.
This is East End, Inc. We heard science writer Deva Sobel talking about her book, The Glass Universe, how the ladies of the Harvard Observatory took the measure of the universe. The book was published in December 2016 by Viking. Other works by Deva Sobel about the exploration of the universe include Longitude, 1996, and Galileo's Daughter, 2000, both available as paperbacks from Penguin Putnam. Some upcoming literary events on the East End include events produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, all on Saturdays at 5 p.m. On September 2nd, historian Blanche Wiesen Cook reads from her acclaimed biography, Eleanor Roosevelt, The War Years and After, 1939 to 1962, Volume 3 of the biography. On September 9th, author Annette Hinkle reads from the new book, Sag Harbor Cinema. On September 16th, Professor Mark Fasanella presents Ralph Fasanella, Images of Optimism, about his painter father's work, celebrating urban life, workers, and ordinary people. On Tuesday, September 19th at 6:30 p.m., biologist James Costa presents Darwin's Backyard, How Small Experiments Led to a Big Theory. The book includes do-it-yourself experiments. More events are listed at caniosbooks.com. Previous East End Inc. programs are archived online at eastendinc.blogspot.com, where you'll find a link to the East End Inc. podcasts. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Soka and Marianne Calandro. This is Hazel Kahn.